Well, election results are in. In Kansas, that means a harder turn to the right, while in Missouri, Claire McCaskill may have received just what she wanted. Ahead on Up to Date, the political pundits analyze what yesterday's primary outcomes mean for the November election. Will Missouri Governor Jay Nixon have a tough fight against Republican Dave Spence? What will Kansas Governor Sam Brownback be able to do with a strongly conservative contingent in the State House? And what changes in Missouri with the passing of Amendment 2? It's Up to Date after this hour's news.
Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Well, the voters have spoken, and Missouri Congressman Todd Akin is the pick to take on Democratic Senator Claire McCaskill this fall. In Kansas, conservatives have romped to big wins, clearing the way for Governor Sam Brownback's very conservative agenda. Today, we'll kick around all the results and what it means for our two states in the years ahead. With us are our political pundits. Dave Helling is my partner in crime at the Kansas City Star. David, any sleep last night?
Not much. Yes. Great to be here, though.
Thank you. Peveril Squire is a political scientist at the University of Missouri Columbia. Professor, nice to have you, too. Good morning.
My pleasure.
Burdette Loomis is also here. He's a political scientist at the University of Kansas. Bird, welcome. Thanks for driving
welcome,
over.
Welcome, and hello to Pev.
Hi, Bird.
Well, last night, Todd Akin topped Sarah Steelman and John Bruner to win the GOP nomination for the U.S. Senate in Missouri, and it wasn't even close, Peveril. Akin had 36% to Bruner's 30% and Steelman's 29%. Does Akin's win amount to an upset of sorts, Peveril?
I think so. Given the survey results we saw in the last few weeks just before the election, he seemed to be running third, but then he got a big boost both from Mike Huckabee, who aired a commercial for him, and then also, of course, with Senator McCaskill, who seemingly endorsed him as the true conservative in the race.
Dave Helling, what a twist that was. We've never seen this kind of thing before where an opponent actually came in, ran ads sort of on behalf of one of her opponents in an attempt to get him across the finish line.
Yeah, and that will give political scientists years of data to study whether that had much of an impact or not. I think it had some, obviously played some role, but I think most voters are fairly sophisticated about what McCaskill was trying to pull in that deal. But to that, I would also add, I think Amendment 2 had an impact. Amendment 2, of course, the right to pray amendment in Missouri. I think that did drive some turnout, particularly in the southern tier of counties, big Mike Huckabee territory to begin with. That may have helped Todd Akin. And the other story, the real story, or the other part of the story to me, Steve, is the collapse of John Bruner. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was up by 20 points 3 weeks out, had the airwaves to himself for 6 months, and after spending
$7.5 million
of his own money,
yeah.
He really went into free fall in the last 2 weeks. And I think the biggest beneficiary of that was clearly Todd Akin, both from St. Louis. I think Republicans in that heavily Republican area, about a third of the vote, watched Bruner implode and turned to support Akin instead. And that's sort of, you add all that together, and that's why he won.
You know, Bert, I want to go back to this notion that you had an incumbent U.S. senator running ads in a race in a disguised sort of way on behalf of one of her opponents, calling him the most conservative candidate in the race, which was a way of sort of promoting him in a backhanded way. Hey, have you ever seen anything quite like this
it's
before?
Not unknown. I there are a couple examples which fail me right now. Pev might have them, but you've seen it happen a couple of times. But honestly, no. And the question is, given not just in Missouri or Kansas, but Texas, you name it, the strength of conservatives in the Republican Party across the country, you wonder if this was the greatest tactic. I mean, we'll see.
Yeah, but just an amazing tactic in many ways.
Yeah, but I think that we are in an era in which I don't think that some of the normal rules apply. Dave and I are talking about going right toward the middle, for example. And so Claire wanted to move as far to the opponent as far to the right as possible.
Peveril, what do you attribute Aiken's win to? What two or three things would you point to here?
Well, I was a little surprised. For me, last night, the big question was who was going to win in St. Louis, given that Bruner and Aiken both can call that their home territory. And Aiken clearly had a strong support from the people that do know him, and then he was able to pick up support from a lot of people around the rest of the state who are not very familiar with him. And I think it really was the ads, the Huckabee ad and the McCaskill ad, which introduced him to much of the state, and both sent strong signals to a very conservative electorate that this was the guy who was probably the most conservative among three fairly conservative people running for Senate, and that, you know, gave him an edge that got him up to 36% of the vote. It wasn't a huge blowout, but it was certainly a more comfortable margin than I think anyone would have predicted.
Well, here's something else that just absolutely floored me, Bird. And again, coming from out of state, you might have an interesting perspective on this. Todd Aiken absolutely defied conventional wisdom here in that he didn't go negative against either of his challengers. Both Steelman and Bruner did. Did that make a difference?
I don't know. I mean, in a race like this, it's really hard to say.
But going negative in this day and age is just you're just asking for.
But in a sense, you've got three pretty darn conservative candidates, and so the question is that gonna help you at all? And it may well be that the McCaskill's endorsement, whatever, was more powerful than anything else. But I do think it's. A fascinating turn, and it contrasts sharply with the experience in Kansas, where fairly conservative legislators were getting attacked by very conservative legislators.
I was going to say there was all kinds of negative attacks going on in Kansas, Dave Helling, and yet Todd Aiken soars to the top by not going negative.
Well, remember, the classic formula in a three-person primary is to let two of the candidates beat the hell out of each other, which in this case happened with Sarah Steelman and John Bruner. Both their campaigns and their affiliated political action committees. The third candidate then stays above the fray and gets the fallout from the other two beating each other up, and in this case, Todd Aiken. We've seen that in Kansas City politics before where you have a multi-candidate primary. So I think frankly, Todd Aiken is not predisposed to using negative ads. But in addition to that, I think tactically they decided, let the other two guys beat each other up and we'll get the fallout from that. And that's exactly what happened.
Professor Squire, did that surprise you?
A little bit. But, you know, when you look at all these ads that are running, you really need a scorecard to keep straight whose ad says what. And you've got so many groups running ads on behalf of candidates and support of candidates that, again, it's really difficult if you're just sort of a not very tuned-in observer to keep straight who's saying what. So the fact that the Chamber of Commerce came out and attacked Steelman as being just like McCaskill, it's hard to tell who that was backing, who was benefiting from that other than the two opponents, which one may have been stronger behind it, which appears to be Bruner. You really have to be in the know to figure that out.
Dave Helling, let's just look ahead here a little bit. You know, is there any question whatsoever that Todd Aiken was the candidate that Claire McCaskill most wanted to face here?
None, but we should be a little careful about that because I think there might be a tendency today to sort of lump Todd Aiken in with other conservatives who have won other Senate primaries this year, Ted Cruz down in Texas, Deb Fischer, Richard Murdoch. But I don't think Todd Aiken fits precisely in that category. He's as conservative as they are. But he's been in Congress for 12 years. So he has lost the outsider argument.
The fresh face.
The fresh face. Mm-hmm. The I'm going to Washington to clean it up. He's lost that argument, or at least he can't make it as effectively as, say, a John Bruner could have. So we have to keep that in mind. He also, as conservative as he is, has a rather lengthy earmarking record. You know, earmarks where you spend money on projects, often by inserting the appropriations in line item bills. And Claire in a normal race, that would sort of be a wash. But Claire McCaskill is famously anti-earmark, aggressively has been from the beginning. in some ways, she can run to the right of Todd Akin on government spending, at least in terms of pork barrel politics. So looking forward, we should not, I don't anticipate, and I don't think Missouri is ready for this classic Tea Party outsider neophyte contest that we'll see in other states.
Because Todd Cruz simply isn't that.
He is not that. He is a member of Congress. Remember, 2 years ago, Missouri Republicans nominated another member of Congress to run for the Senate, Roy Blunt, member of the House. I think Missouri is less of a Tea Party state than we know, and perhaps more of a socially conservative state than we know, which is a little different in my view. So it sets up a fascinating race for me until November.
Peveril, do you buy that?
No, I think that's right. I think the Tea Party influence in Missouri has been much more muted than it has been in many other states. Missouri Republicans continue to nominate people who can't argue that they're really outsiders. And I think Akin is McCaskill's preferred choice simply because he does present a large target. He's had to go on record on lots of votes. He's taken very conservative positions, and as was mentioned, he's also been a fairly aggressive earmarker, which is something where McCaskill can try to again to position herself in the preferred place this time by arguing that she's the one who actually works against earmarks.
You know, Senator McCaskill had a news conference this morning down in the East Bottoms at a sheet metal shop in which, you know, she talked about the different aspects of this campaign. She was asked at one point if religion is going to be much of an issue in this campaign, given the fact, Professor Squire, that Todd Akin talks a lot about religion and invokes God's name quite often. In fact, let's listen to one of Todd Akin's final ads of the primary campaign, in which he speaks directly to the camera.
America was founded on the unique vision that our Creator gave us life, the foundation of freedom, liberty to speak as you choose and own what you earn, and the pursuit of happiness, the call to fully and courageously live the dream God puts in our hearts. In times of crisis, when the dream seemed lost, great patriots turned to God, gave their all, and rekindled freedom's flame. This now is our duty and our time. I'm Todd Akin, and I approve this message.
Professor Squire, what do you make of that?
Well, clearly Akin is positioning himself in a way that he's comfortable positioning himself and appealing to a fairly wide swath of Republicans, voters in Missouri, who are rallied by those calls. We saw, you know, strong support for Amendment 2 yesterday, and I think Akin wanted to clearly identify himself with people who think along those lines, and I think he'll clearly be their choice in November.
Do you think this sort of talk about God, this sort of invoking of religion into the campaign, Professor, is that going to turn some middle-of-the-road voters off, or are they going to gravitate to this?
Well, I think we'll probably see less of it as we head towards November. That's a sort of appeal that works particularly well in a Republican primary that's heavily contested.
But even last night in his acceptance speech, his victory speech, Todd Akin was talking sort of along the same lines.
It's something he's comfortable doing. But again, I think as he looks towards what works as the middle here in Missouri, he'll probably tone that down, and my guess is he'll probably focus more on economic messages, mm-hmm. since that will probably motivate most voters.
David?
Yeah, that ad, if it does run, may or may not switch some votes, but it will be buried, Steve, by the third-party ads that are on their way to the state of Missouri. They've already been here.
Crossroads this
now,
morning. Right. Carl Rose Group already announcing a big buy this morning.
And the reason is now Missouri, I think, almost universally will be considered a competitive state. I think there was some argument 48 hours ago that had Bruner or even Steelman been the nominee that McCaskill was in trouble. But I think everyone will now believe, certainly the Democratic Party will believe, that McCaskill at least has a fighting chance in this race, and so they're going to spend money in Missouri that they might otherwise have spent in another state. That will provoke the Republicans to answer and the political action committees and the 501c4s. And this state is going to be – because the Republicans believe the McCaskill seat is the most gettable seat in the nation,
yeah.
They will spend every dime they have to try and win the seat. And so – you know, the Aiken ads, even the McCaskill ads, may end up being obscured by these extraordinarily aggressive third-party ads I think we're going to see in the next 100 days.
Let me get our listeners involved here. If you voted by chance for Todd Aiken last night and can call us and tell us why, we'd like to hear from you. 816-235-2888, our email address, update@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. Burdette Loomis, Dave Helling just said that Claire McCaskill suddenly has a fighting chance. She was all but dead and
right.
buried those, 2 weeks ago.
The polls look really, really bad.
A fighting chance?
Absolutely. But I also think that the one name we haven't bandied around here a little bit is Barack Obama.
No, exactly.
And this, I was talking to someone this morning, and they were talking about a county commission race being decided on sort of national grounds. And we heard this 2 years ago. And so I think the depth of the pro or particularly the anti-Obama sentiments are so strong that a lot of this is going to be contested over her record in support of Obama, his opposition, and particularly on health care.
Hmm. And just to finish Bird's thought, which is absolutely right, Missouri is a plus 4 or 5 or 6 point Republican state today. We tend to think of it as a 50-50 state. It isn't that anymore. So a generic Democrat statewide goes into a race several points down. She has to make up that gap, plus whatever gap is created by her support for the Health Care Act or the stimulus or other things. So we should not overestimate the mountain she needs to climb. It's pretty steep, but it is less steep than it was this time last week. And I think nationally, Democrats will respond on that basis.
Peveril, is Todd Aiken the favorite here?
I would say if I had to put money down right now, he probably is. But we do have a ways to go, and we do have another statewide contest that we've tended to forget. We have a Democratic governor seeking reelection, and he seems to be in reasonably good shape. So I think the state does trend towards the Republicans, yet we do see some Democrats that have kept their heads above water, and Nixon may be able to help McCaskill a little.
816-235-2888 is our phone number here. KJ writes this comment on KCUR's Facebook page. She writes, "The really scary thing about the election last night is the lack of turnout. This is, or was, he says, in no way a total referendum." Do we know what the turnout was last night?
No, I don't. You know, I did. I want to say 20-25%. Not huge. Particularly poor, I think, in our area on this side of the state. Once again, you get the sense that Kansas Cityans don't feel like they really have a stake in statewide elections. Even Claire McCaskill, of course, unopposed, doesn't really excite a lot of people on this side of the state, at least so far. But primaries in August are always relatively low turnout affairs. We should get used to that.
And Bird, you're shaking your head.
Well, no, it's just you know, same old. I mean,
on the Kansas side,
But we're gonna, you know. It's not, it's like we discover this every 2 years, and so really the benefits go to whoever can turn their folks out. Seem to work that way in both states.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Peveril, you mentioned other races going on in Missouri right now. There was this other race on the ballot last night that happened to be the governor's race in Missouri. Missouri Governor Jay Nixon's a Democrat. He found out who his opponent is going to be, and that's a businessman named Dave Spence. Peveril, how tough will Dave Spence be for the sitting incumbent governor, Jay Nixon? What do you see happening there?
Well, Dave Spence has been running ads for the last couple of months. He's, again, a businessman, has to introduce himself to the statewide electorate. He will probably do reasonably well because he's a Republican and he's going to get all the Republican votes. But he has kind of a tough task, and that is that Nixon has managed to preside over a state in tough economic times where he hasn't raised taxes and he's managed to balance the budget, and he's made some tough calls, particularly against some Democratic constituencies. And so I think Spence probably has a harder time making a strong argument that there needs to be a change than probably most other Republican challengers around the country have to make.
Boy, and Dave Spence has had his stumbles, hit a few holes in the ground the last few weeks.
Yeah, the mountain is steep for him as well, because as the professor points out, Jay Nixon has a relatively moderate record in terms of how he's run the government. Plus, He has great popularity in traditional Republican strongholds around Springfield and Joplin because of the way he responded to the tornado. That's going to help him here, help him there rather dramatically. The only real wild card that I see is whether or not business people like David Humphreys and Rex Singfield decide they really don't like Jay Nixon and write six-figure checks, seven-figure checks to Dave Spence and help him sort of even the playing field. You don't sense that so far, but it may be that if it's a five, six-point race as we get closer, that money will come forward and then Spence might have a chance. Beyond that, I don't think he – I think Jay Nixon is at this point the prohibitive favorite in that race.
You know, Burdette Loomis, there is this ongoing debate in political parties on both sides of the aisle about how to approach situations like the one Governor Jay Nixon has faced. You know, some Democrats say, hey, you've got to govern from the left and really energize your base and cater to those folks. Others say, no, you got to move to more to the middle, and in a tough state like Missouri, that's the way to govern. You know, it appears that Jay Nixon has found the right formula, again, based on the polls and based on the type of economy he's had to run up against the last couple
of years. Yeah, I mean, aside from a couple of states, Massachusetts maybe, pretty hard to govern from the left in this country by and large. And most Democrats end up moving toward the center. They need business support in one way or another. So I think his formula is very much in keeping with, say, Oklahoma governors in the past.
Kathleen Sebelius is a good example.
Even though she is pilloried, that's much the way she governed. So, I mean, I don't think there's much of a choice. The question is, do you have the skill to do it? And from what I've seen, Jay Nixon is reasonably skilled at pulling this off.
But the other thing to keep in mind is, and I think the professor brought this up, is how long his coattails might be for McCaskill and other Democrats. And you don't get the sense that he has many coattails.
Robin sort of pick him one race at a time. Right.
Plus, Robin Carnahan 2 years ago was crushed by Roy Blunt. And I think a lot of Democrats kept expecting Jay Nixon to raise his hand a little bit, which he was reluctant to do. Didn't want to spend any of his capital on anything except Jay Nixon. So whether some of that spills over into McCaskill is an open question. When you couple it with the lack of enthusiasm for Obama, even among Democrats in the state, because Obama isn't going to campaign here, that hurts turnout. Claire McCaskill has to have huge turnout in St. Louis and Kansas City to have a chance. If Jay Nixon isn't driving it, because he's perceived as the walk-away winner in that race, and Barack Obama is playing in other states, that can't be good news for the Senate candidate on the Democratic side.
Again, if our listeners want to chime in with who they're going to back in this race, Claire McCaskill or Todd Aiken, our phone number 816-235-2888 and our email address updatedate@kcur.org. Well, Peter Kinder beat back a tough challenge from Brad Lager last night in Missouri to win a third Republican nomination for lieutenant governor. Peter Kinder has run into all sorts of issues in recent years, including his spending of taxpayer dollars on hotel rooms, particularly over in St. Louis. Given all that, Pev, why did he survive this primary? Very tough challenge from Brad Lager.
I was a little surprised. He has a tremendous amount of baggage that he's bringing into the race with him. And he had some tough ads run against him by his opponent and by people on behalf of his opponent. Yet I think name recognition probably carried him through in the end. He's a name that's familiar to a lot of Republicans. They may have thought he was getting picked on. He did have his childhood friend Rush Limbaugh come out in support of him. So it's good to have well-known friends. But he managed to just eke out a victory, and now it becomes a fairly tough race for him going forward because, of course, a lot of Republicans may not be altogether comfortable with his record.
I was going to say, on the Democratic side of the ledger, very crowded primary field to be the nominee for lieutenant governor. A former state auditor, Susan Monti, who also was chair of the Missouri Democratic Party, sweeps to a very easy win. Any early thoughts on that race, David?
Well, I think the general consensus will be that that's a toss-up race, particularly because of Peter Kinder's problems. On the other hand, Missourians have shown a propensity to split that vote just on sort of generic grounds.
Vote for Jay Nixon.
Vote for the Democrat for the governor. You vote for the Republican for lieutenant governor or vice versa as sort of a check and balance. Whether people make that sort of precise choice in the voting booth is a little problematic. But I think generally Missourians are fond of that idea that you have two executive branch members from different parties. So we'll see. You know, it is fascinating that even though, as I suggested earlier, Missouri is becoming more and more of a Republican state like an Alabama or a Mississippi, the Democrats here are still pretty feisty. I mean, they are nominating well-known, aggressive, talented politicians to run for virtually all of the offices across the state, unlike Kansas, where the Democrats, to a large degree, have really abandoned the field. And that sets up an interesting dynamic in all of these races, yeah. And it'll be fascinating to see what the interplay is between a Monty, a McCaskill, a Nixon, even an Emanuel Cleaver or Lacey Clay over on the St. Louis side, and see if a rising tide can lift those boats or if it's just race after race after race, and that's what the results show.
Bert Loomis, let's get down into the weeds a little bit into political science land here. You know, in your state of Kansas, the governor and lieutenant governor run as a team. In Missouri, they run separately from each other. In theory, you can have a Democratic governor,
right,
as we do now, and a Republican lieutenant governor. Does either way make more sense than the other way?
I mean,
does anybody care about this?
Actually, Kansas consciously changed this in the 1970s when it went to a four-year term for governor, which makes sense. In 1974, it went to a ticket. And so previously, there had been Democratic governors and Republican lieutenant governors. That seems to make a lot of sense to me. If you leave the state, for example, does the lieutenant governor have? Right. I mean, it's just a kind of crazy situation.
Mm-hmm.
So it strikes me that making that one choice of a team makes a lot of sense.
You know, last night also in Missouri, Dave Helling, the prayer amendment passed that ensures a right to pray in public, or at least that's what reporters billed it as. Any big surprise there?
Well, here's the big surprise. There was a tweet that went out last night from an unnamed Republican in Missouri, and I'm paraphrasing here, but the essence was Claire McCaskill is winning the Republican primary in Missouri, because I think some sort of mainstream Republicans in the state are worried about Aiken as their nominee, for the reasons we've discussed. One of the effects, I believe, of putting Amendment 2 on the August ballot rather than November, which, remember, Republicans proposed it in the General Assembly, it was passed, and then Jay Nixon got to decide whether it went in August or November. By putting it on in August, that gave a boost to Aiken. And I'm not sure the Republicans in the General Assembly, if you had them in a corner with a beer, would say that was what they had in mind. I think they much would have preferred to put Amendment 2 on the November ballot because, let's face it, it was there to drive turnout.
But Nixon makes that pick, and he politically wisely said, let's put it in August,
right,
so it doesn't drive turnout when I'm facing my main,
right,
challenge.
So you can make the case that Republicans in the General Assembly were too clever by half by proposing this amendment and then having it in some ways bite them by giving Aiken a boost instead of, say, John Bruner or Sarah Steelman, again, who might have been stronger against McCaskill going forward.
I just want to touch on the presidential race for a moment before we go to a break. You know, Barack Obama is not expected to carry either Kansas or Missouri. How does the race just nationally look to you right now, Peverell Squire? What do you see happening?
Well, I think we're in a position right now where we have a pretty good idea what November might look like. I think most people know how they're going to vote. There really aren't very many undecideds out there. We know a lot of states are clearly already in one camp or the other. And so we're looking at a race where it will be tight, and the president looks to be a little bit in the lead right now with probably reasonably good prospects to hold on to that tight lead.
He's the favorite right now, Bird, at least slightly.
I'd say I couldn't give a much of a different answer than Pev. You look at the polling; it's pretty tight. You look at the electoral vote, projected electoral vote, a little less tight. And what's striking is how little things have changed over 4, 5, 6 months.
Yeah,
over a year. If you go back and look a year, the margin is almost identical to what it is today.
I would still argue, though, if the economic numbers don't begin to move in a stronger direction, I still think Barack Obama's in trouble. We get through September, October with lousy numbers.
You want to do a little political science here? Is we look at the jobs numbers, but the stock market's up, which is a future indicator. Personal income is up, and some of the models in political science use personal income as a a better indicator than something as gross as jobs.
Okay. So it depends on what numbers you're looking at,
right,
you're saying.
Right.
Yeah. Dave Helling, you see the presidential race any differently?
I agree with all sides. because I do think, and I've written this, that for the vast majority of people who will vote in November, their minds are made up, particularly at the presidential level. I mean, you either like Barack Obama's approach or you don't. And those decisions were reached, in my view, 6 months ago. There is still a slight chance, taking jobs numbers and other things aside, there's a slight chance that the vice presidential pick will make a difference, or that some stumble in a debate will make a difference, or something on the campaign trail, or some foreign policy crisis. I mean, those things all play a role, can play a role. But if we held the election today, if we all went to the polls today, I think Barack Obama would be the favorite by a couple of points and maybe 20, 30 votes in the Electoral College.
Well, speaking of vice presidential running mates, Professor Squire, who's it going to be for Mitt Romney? Why don't you reveal it now for all the world to hear?
It will not be Sarah Palin. I think it's the one sort of thing we can say with any confidence. You know, we've heard a lot of speculation. A lot of reporters seem to suggest the same shortlist has sort of surfaced. I would think Portman out of Ohio would be a reasonable choice, given the state's competitive, and it's somebody about whom there won't be any questions raised about whether he's prepared to do the job. So I don't think Romney's apt to take a great risk, and it'll probably be a name that will be reasonably familiar.
We should point out quickly that one of the losers last night was Sarah Palin.
She had been taking the words out of my
mouth. Yeah, she was winning. She was on quite a winning streak, had been pitching shutouts all over the country.
If she had won last night.
If Sarah Steelman had won last night, then the idea of Sarah Palin as a vice presidential choice would not have been a joke. It would have caused some chuckles, but it would not have been a joke. She would have had an enormous influence in the Republican Party as they head to the convention. Steelman's loss last night, and therefore Palin's, I think really slowed that momentum and suggests that her role will be less significant than, again, it might have been 2 days ago.
Bert, who's the VP going to be?
I mean, I'd say right now you'd have to think Portman is number one. You know, it's kind of a boom. You read a boomlet a day. There was a little Ryan boomlet, and then it was shot down. Portman comes from Ohio. No indication that it helps him in Ohio, by the way.
Yeah.
Really. Has raised $500,000. You know, and I think that Romney would go with someone very solid and, as Pev said, someone that there's no question could walk into the job tomorrow, which remains a big question with someone like Sarah Palin. Yeah.
The typical Veep calculus is the pick won't help, but it could hurt. And given that, and given Romney's approach, I think he'll pick someone who, at minimum, won't hurt. And that suggests a Portman or maybe Tim Pawlenty, some other people like that.
Okay, let's take a break. In our second half, we're going to turn to the Kansas side of the state line. So I'm going to say goodbye to Peverell Squire, again, a political scientist at the University of Missouri Columbia. Pev, we sure appreciated your time today.
My pleasure.
All the best. Thanks very much. In our second half, we'll talk about Kansas and that big conservative sweep last night in the Sunflower State. What happened? We'll find out. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. Welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed yesterday's conversation with psychologist Wes Crenshaw on the challenges students entering high school face, you can find it in our other previous broadcasts at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the show, we talk with an expert on how to end congressional deadlock, and Brian McTavish has his weekend to-do list. This hour, talking about Kansas politics and last night's big primaries in the Sunflower State, I'm joined again, Dave Helling from the Kansas City Star, Burdette Loomis, a political scientist over at KU. Bird, a big, big night for conservatives in Kansas last night. They swept to control of the state Senate. How big a deal is this?
It's a big deal.
Yeah.
Arguably the most important election maybe in a couple of decades in Kansas, even more important than most gubernatorial races. You're really talking about giving Sam Brownback the chance to enact a highly conservative agenda, even more than he's been able to do so far, with almost no bothersome interference by moderate Republicans or Democrats. Now, we'll see how this works out. And I do think that we have to acknowledge that with some of these conservative wins, particularly Smith's win, say, in Johnson County, mm-hmm. He may run into a Democratic opponent that could win that election. But by and large, this was a tremendous victory for Sam Brownback, his chief of staff, former chief of staff and political advisor, Dave Kensinger, the Kansas Chamber of Commerce, and the Koch brothers.
Yeah, no question about it. Well, let's get our listeners to chime in here. How do you feel about Kansas now that conservatives have swept into power, in not only in the state house, but also the state senate? What does it mean for the state going forward? 816-235-2888, our email address, updateatkcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. Dave Helling, what do you make of it? It's your state, too.
Well, Bird mentioned the changes in the legislature, but I think where we will see the impact of yesterday's vote next year will come in a real battle over how judges are picked in Kansas. In essence, Sam Brownback controls the executive. He now controls the legislature. And I think he wants to, and David Kensinger, want to control the judicial branch, largely because the only hindrance to changing the way schools are paid for in the state hinges on what judges decide. So the real battle will be there. And I don't think
they should win that battle now.
And they should win.
But
they
it takes a long time for that to wind out.
And we'll see how long.
Because it takes – you got to wait for
people
openings
to quit
on the
and some other
than time for the governor to make selections.
But, and maybe Bird disagrees, but to me that's where the rubber will meet the road. They're going to argue about school finance. There certainly will not be an attempt to roll back the tax cut that was approved last year. I don't think.
I think there's some technical issues, and I think they may make it a little more palatable than the rough edges. But oh no, in general.
The other thing that we have to keep in mind a little bit, and something that might ameliorate some of the impact of yesterday's vote or change it, is that Sam Brownback remains fairly unpopular in the state, at least according to the opinion polls that we've been able to see. And of course, he must face the voters again if he decides to run for re-election. That may cause him to, you know, use the dreaded moderate word in his own attempts to pass legislation. Because he's unpopular for a reason. Now, I'm not sure we know exactly what that reason is, but if he concludes that pushing an aggressive conservative agenda might hurt his reelection chances, it might change. But Bird is right. The moderates won fair and square. They won almost across the board. The conservatives. I'm sorry, I said the moderates. The conservatives won fair and square across the board. They get to govern, and we'll see how they do it.
Even Senate President Steve Morris from the district in southwest Kansas, he had been Senate President for a couple of terms. He was ousted last night by a more conservative challenger.
Right, absolutely. I mean, you really saw it from Johnson County all the way to southwest Kansas, with a couple of exceptions. And indeed, Vicky Schmidt in Topeka probably won because – by 159 votes or something, mm-hmm. because enough Democrats switched over to vote for her. That was probably the margin of victory.
It was predictable. I told Bert on the way in, it was as predictable as, you know, the rain in spring that the conservatives would do well yesterday in Kansas, because primaries are low turnout, high motivation affairs. Conservative voters almost always are more motivated and turn out for those things. Moderates are moderates because they don't pay as much attention to government for whatever reason, and they don't typically vote as much. And I think that was true in Johnson County and in other places.
I think that... That's generally right, but I am now willing to countenance the idea that between the 2010 and 2012 elections, there is a sea change in Kansas politics, that it has moved a big ratchet to the right, probably not returning to the previous center anytime soon.
Then how do you explain Brownback's popularity problems, Bird?
I was just going to go there. I don't get it. Why the governor's numbers are what seemingly what they are, and yet he had a huge, huge win last night.
I mean, I think that if you look at the other if you look at the Senate numbers, those aren't all that great either. They're in the 40s, as I recall, and so I think people are not happy. By and large,
with the U.S. Senators Pat Roberts
yeah,
and Jerry Moran,
but with,
you're saying.
With those who are governing right now. Beyond that, I think that Governor Brownback has this core of 30% of the people that are very supportive, but I don't see him as a particularly popular personal figure, a dynamic personal figure, and so it is a little bit of a mystery to be sure.
But he keeps winning. Let's give him his due.
Absolutely.
Wins. Every time he turns around, he's won something else.
Well, the other thing to keep in mind is some of the dissatisfaction with Sam Brownback may actually come, as strange as this sounds, from the right, who don't think he's aggressive enough. I mean, you always have to factor that a little bit into favorable, unfavorable, that we always tend to think it's the other side, but there's a fringe of the right who may not think
he's aggressive enough.
And that may have some responsibility for his numbers.
What does this mean for Kansas going forward, this big conservative sweep last night? 816-235-2888. Let's go to some phone calls. Pat from Overland Park, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am a unaffiliated independent voter. I wanted to vote yesterday in the Republican primary for the more moderate candidates, but was precluded from doing so from the way I understand election law, in a court case that ruled that unaffiliated voters had to declare a party, which I don't care to do. So I felt like I was excluded from the democratic process, and it seemed like pretty much a setup job by the conservative Republicans.
David?
Yeah, this is a very subtle point, but it's an important one because I'm a registered independent as well. So I did not cast a ballot yesterday because I don't care to declare a party. But we should always remember that primaries are primarily, to use a pun, party affairs. They are not election affairs. They are to pick each party's nominee for the general election. I've often argued that the parties ought to pay for the primaries because, really, they're not small-d democratic exercises like November is. And so while I sympathize with the caller, and by the way, the rules in Kansas are not the same as the rules in Missouri. In Missouri, you can go pick up a ballot of either party, cast your vote. You can't do both, but you can do one or the other, and then you don't have to register as a member of that party. In Kansas, you do have to you become a Republican if you cast a Republican
but
vote.
You can
change it back. You
right
can just
away,
turn around
day.
And change it back.
Yeah.
But we should just keep in mind that if you feel disenfranchised in a primary, it's because it's a different animal, really, than November.
But just not to get too political science-y here, that's beginning to change. It's already changed in California and Washington state, where you have these blanket primaries, and the two top vote getters run against each other. And so I think there's a
even if they're from the same party.
Absolutely, yeah. You got that in the general election, several congressional races. So I think that the small d notion of democracy on primaries is open to contest right now. And I'm not sure exactly how I feel about it. I think earlier on I was more in your camp. That you
well, I'm
described.
Not saying it's a good
no,
thing
no,
or a bad
thing. No,
but
the party should get to – but at the end of the day, I think that lots of people are being excluded.
In Utah, for example, they don't even have primaries. The party gets together in a big room and picks nominees.
No, they have primaries.
Orrin Hatch, for example, was renominated. Was he not in a convention as opposed to a preference primary?
No, he
explain it to our listeners.
He didn't quite get enough votes to stop a primary, and so they're having a primary election
okay.
there.
Well, but I guess my point is that just as a political science matter, primaries are a different kind of thing, or
absolutely.
Always have been than the general election.
Let's go to Al from Kansas City, Missouri. Al, welcome to Up to Date with our political pundits. Good morning.
Good morning. You asked what we think that this move to the right is about, and my feeling or response is, and I see it in other places in the country as well, that it's a sea change, it's a reaction rather than a proactive move by people based on fear, and very similar to the late 1950s, early 60s, there was this kind of conservative trend as well in the 1950s and early 60s out of fear. In the case of the 50s, it was fear. You know, it was a post-war era where people were afraid of ever going through that again. Mm-hmm. In our case, it's a fear of having to go through the Bush era again and the embarrassment that it caused the Republican Party and, of course, many of us. And to me, that's what it means. It means that this is a fear-based reaction rather than any kind of really constructive reaction or action. Sorry.
And, Al, you're suggesting that the pendulum will probably swing back. Am I hearing you right?
Oh, yes, and I think when it swings back, it's not going to be flower power and black power and feminism. It's going to be a real profound social movement that is not going to be pretty. And that's coming, you know, so this just is the way the political spectrum works. And we did it. We saw it in the late 60s, early 70s. And I think we're going to see something much worse and much more profound if we don't start being a little more intelligent in the way we move through politics. Hmm.
Al, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. And, Bird, this notion that Al just raised, that this is temporary, this is a swinging of the pendulum, do you buy that?
I mean, I think that we've got to be careful with our metaphors. Mm-hmm. Pendulums go back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
It won't go back to where it was. And he's not suggesting that. I do think that at some point, if you lard up the right so far and cut taxes so far, for example, in Kansas— and endanger public education. Yeah, that there are centrists, there are people who think, wait a minute, we have gone too far.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the fear, a lot of the fear here is, number one, I think Obama comes back into it, and he personifies this sense that we have this huge government. And it's a reasonably large government, but we're not spending that much money as compared to the past. It's far more complex. But what's striking is how simplified everything becomes. And everything becomes totally black and white, leaving people in the middle who want to make policy, want to compromise, very little room.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is interesting because in Kansas particularly, the budget has been cut over and over and over again in recent years, big cuts, and yet you don't sense the public, and based on the votes yesterday, that people are unhappy with that or unhappy with the direction that state government is headed right now.
I guess I think that this past year's tax cut, which is huge, and also
several billion dollars,
and carves out certain professions like law and farming for people to pay essentially no state tax. I think that will be the acid test, that because revenues are going to drop, no matter what the Brownback administration says, no matter what Arthur Laffer says, revenues are going to drop substantially. And then the question is, will that attract the attention of Kansas voters?
We
should not discount, in my view, the anger at the health care law. I think that fueled a lot of what happened in 2010. I've never covered any issue in my career that provokes such a visceral reaction of anger and distrust and disgust by opponents of the bill. I mean, you cover, you know, Steve, you and I have covered issues for 30 years, and people are for or against measures, but people really hate the health care bill.
Here's my
and I think that spreads into other things,
other
issues, and feeds into this critique of Obama as a big government guy, and that's what really we're looking at.
Does anyone know what's in the health care bill? They it's this great categorization
of
Obama care, and then dig down an
they
inch,
all like it.
And they don't, well, they like parts of it.
So why is that, Bert? And my argument is because people see Obamacare, if we can call it that, as a reflection, a structure of an approach to government that says we as government can fix what we think is more of a private concern, whether or not you agree with that. But as a political matter, people see it as a symbol.
No, I think
the
that's
specifics
absolutely
of it are not that important. It is a symbol. And it is a symbol that really irritates a lot of people. And I think that stain, if I can call it that, has spread to other parts of our politics and led us to the place we are now.
We're analyzing last night's big primary elections in both Kansas and Missouri. Kim from Overland Park, welcome to the show.
And one of my concerns is going to be birth control issues. I mean, rape victims not being able to get the morning after pill. other states who have gone very conservative, like Oklahoma, who have now made it that from fertilization, that is now life. So some birth control, like IUDs, are no longer going to be legal. And that is a big concern that I have, because, I'm sorry, morning after pill, I think, should be available to every rape victim if they want it.
Okay. Kim, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. You know, Frank Morris, KCUR's news director, reported this morning that Republicans opted to, in Johnson County, opted to bypass a unity breakfast this morning when these things are usually held. Republicans said it might take, you know, just a little longer for the wounds to heal this year. You know, how do moderates and conservatives continue to coexist in the same party going forward? Or are we going to see moderates begin to say, enough is enough, we're breaking away, Bird?
When is enough as enough? We've been talking about this for a decade.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this was clearly the most intense battle. And honestly, the moderates raised a lot of money and fought pretty hard here, which makes the conservatives' victory all the more impressive in many ways. I don't know. I think that certainly there's a great reluctance to change parties, consider becoming a Democrat, maybe not voting for a Democrat like Sebelius, but becoming a Democrat. And so I can't be very optimistic until you get some real serious policy changes, like cuts to schools, whatever. And then in those instances, the Senate is so far away, but a governor, if you've got potholes, if your kid is suddenly in a class with 35 other kids, then you can hold that governor responsible. And I think that's easier to do than, say, the Senate.
Okay. We're out of time.
Went fast, as it always does.
A lot of stuff to yak about today. I want to thank Dave Helling from the Kansas City Star. David, always appreciate it.
Great.
And Burdette Loomis, a political scientist over at KU. Bird, always good to have you,
too. My pleasure, Steve.
Good morning. And Byron from Olathe, sorry I couldn't get to your call this morning. You can learn more about our guests and get more information about our program. It's at kcur.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Tomorrow on the show, how to pull Congress back from the brink of institutional collapse, and Brian McTavish with his weekend to-do list. Our show is produced by Steven Steichman. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.